Joining me now is Brian Dunning. Brian is the host of a very, very popular podcast called Skeptoid, which is subheaded Critical Analysis of Pop Phenomenon. It's a weekly science podcast that's won some awards and has something like 150 or more thousand people downloading the podcast on a regular basis. So I've invited him to join me here today and talk a little bit about doing a podcast like that, and also how it's possible to be skeptical in a time when alternative facts have taken command. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Nice talking to you today. Before we get into anything else, you did a podcast, I guess, about 3 weeks ago that I loved, on the difference between skepticism, which I'm full of, and cynicism, which I try not to be full of.
You and me both.
Can you explain the difference for my audience?
Well, being cynical and being skeptical are often confused because the term skeptic tends to have a pretty negative connotation, but so I'm trying to recapture the term a little bit. Basically, being skeptical means just having some kind of a bar, having some kind of a bar of evidence that the things you believe have to meet, not just accepting things. Whereas being cynical means you can just kind of arbitrarily turn everything down. You just say no to everything and don't believe anything. It's being inherently negative versus being skeptical, which is being, you know, investigative.
I often like to think of skepticism as being the kind of person, if you're a skeptic, you're the kind of person who says, I'm going to need to see some evidence of that.
Exactly, yeah. And that's basically what skepticism is. Ideally, you wouldn't do it in conversation like that.
I would.
Yeah.
I actually have said to people, I'm going to need some evidence of that, when they've made outrageous claims.
Yeah, and society is full of outrageous claims. And just things that people generally believe because they've heard that just simply aren't true.
So why do you think it's so hard to convince people that what they believe is wrong?
Because that's kind of what the definition of a belief is. It's the things that we've concluded are true. And everyone believes that what they believe is true. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe it. So you're telling people that something is not true, something that they've already decided is true based on whatever their criteria are. And most people just simply don't have the science background or the tools to really truly analyze things to determine whether they're scientifically valid or not. So they tend to go on things like, you know, what they saw on TV, what they heard from friends, things like that that aren't too reliable.
Why wouldn't they then go with a person who knows what they're talking about, telling them, okay, here, point by point, are the reasons why you think that's true, but it's not?
Well, a lot of times, the things that we believe are based on personal experiences. And personal experiences are very, very compelling. If you try some pill, for example, and you feel better later, you're going to decide, hey, this pill works great. Whatever that pill might have been, and whatever the reason is that you felt better, it's a personal experience, and we tend to place a lot of emphasis on our own brain's analysis of our personal experiences. And you know, it goes the same whether we hear something from a trusted friend. We like our friend. We know our friend has our best interests at heart. We tend to believe the things that they tell us. And as we know from science and sociology and psychology, there's just our brain's personal, our brain's engine of determining what's true and what's not is very anecdotally based, and it's not factually based. It's really hard to start thinking scientifically instead of anecdotally.
I prefer to call it thinking critically, because sometimes thinking scientifically scares people who say, hey, I didn't do well in science in college. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a great term. I would use the same term.
Okay, so how do we teach critical thinking? Is it not taught in our schools?
You know, it's taught in our schools, but in kind of an abstract way. If you have critical thinking in school, it's likely to be something like, oh, the Socratic questions or the Socratic dialogues, things like this that aren't necessarily relevant to our daily life. In fact, this is why I do the podcast Skeptoid, because it kind of directly goes up against the things that people are actually exposed to in daily life and that people actually believe, things like, you know, organic food or gluten-free food, things like this that don't have any scientific validity, but that are very popular in culture.
Yeah, the gluten-free thing has been driving me and my wife crazy for years. For people who don't have celiac disease, but they're sure that if they just ate gluten-free, they would lose weight.
It's amazing. 20 years ago, everyone was healthy. Now today, all of a sudden, everyone's gluten sensitive. But that should be a tip-off for us. Well, gee, maybe it's not the way that I think it is.
You know, another part of it is that they go into supermarkets, and now every supermarket has the gluten-free aisle and maybe even a gluten-free section where they see that and they go, oh, well, this is obviously something that's good for you. They come to the wrong conclusion.
Exactly. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a tremendously profitable food fad, and so all of the food sellers have jumped on it very aggressively.
Then again,
both the retailers and the manufacturers.
Absolutely. But then again, I feel the same way when I go into a Walgreens and I see that they are selling homeopathic products, which are essentially jars of water. And people are fooled into believing that that has some sort of medicinal remedy in it, when in fact it doesn't.
Yeah. For people who work in science communication like I do, homeopathy is definitely one of the pet peeves. It's a hot button. It's something that people believe in very passionately, and yet it is so far from remotely being plausible that it's just an absurdity. It's like a caricature of itself. You're taking these dilutions that are smaller than one atom in an ocean of water that's the size of the Earth's orbit. So far, far, far beyond chemically pure water that contains nothing of this original compound, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't even sell that water. They sell a pill that is supposed to have the spiritual essence of that water. They're selling basically a little lactose pill that claims to have the spiritual essence of chemically pure water. And this is supposed to be able to aggressively treat any condition you want.
Right.
So it's very, very silly, but people don't understand that. People will buy it and say, oh, it's an herbal thing. It's, you know, it's some all-natural treatment. That's the extent of what they think they know about it. And it's marketed so aggressively that they assume it's a real thing, that it works.
I got to go one step further than you. When you say it's silly, I think that that is understating it. I think it's actually dangerous, because people will go into a Walgreens or any place else that sells these homeopathic products, and they will buy them as a cure for what ails them instead of actual medicine.
You're absolutely right. It is very dangerous, but the same can be said of all alternative medicines. Alternative medicine is basically medicine that has been discarded as fraudulent by medical science. That's why we call it alternative. When it works, we call it medicine. So homeopathy is just one example of an entire industry based on, you know, in the worst analysis, fraud, and in the best analysis, ignorance.
Brian, I've been talking about issues like this for a long time, and I have been getting more and more frustrated in the last few years that so many people still believe all of this nonsense, that there are people who will hear what Gwyneth Paltrow tells them to do with a jade egg and where to stick it, and say, well, she must know what she's talking about. And yet when real scientists tell them real important information, they dismiss it as if it's part of some sort of medical conspiracy.
Oh, my gosh, don't put that jade egg in there. The best you can hope to get is an infection.
Right.
And people will dismiss that. Yeah.
So what do we do? What do we do about that celebrity expert culture?
That is a very difficult problem. And the fact that it's hard to solve is why we see it thriving so much. People like me who do science communication for a living, Our goal is to help people get excited and interested and appreciative about what's real. Not just what's science-based, but what's actually real in the world and why there's value in that, rather than whatever it is that Gwyneth Paltrow sells or whatever ghost hunting show you're seeing on television. All of this stuff that just feeds on and erodes the public intellect. I try to get people excited and interested. And that's why I do a podcast that's about interesting subjects, you know, urban legends, things that people have heard. Here's what's actually interesting about the real truth behind this mystery.
Mm-hmm. The problem is, when it comes to eroding the public interest, even though you've got a large number of people downloading and listening to your podcast all the time, more people are watching that idiotic show Long Island Medium and believing that that woman is actually a psychic who can tell things to people about what's actually going on in their lives.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that if you were to not watch an episode of Long Island Medium, but instead watch an episode where professional mentalists are revealing the tricks that she uses to convince people that she has these actual powers. That's far more interesting, and that's going to be more engaging to people. The trick is getting them to watch it.
Absolutely. Speaking of which, didn't you do a pilot for a show called The Skeptologists a few years ago?
I did. A few years ago, we got sort of a team of science superheroes, and the concept for the show was they get the bat signal and they jump into the Batmobile and rush off to debunk the pseudoscience, whatever it was.
Okay, so what happened?
Well, we did get close to a couple of network deals. We did. But we didn't succeed. In fact, at Discovery Channel, we got bumped by hairy bikers. And that just kind of tells you the state of what people find interesting, what people are excited about. And apparently people are more excited about hairy bikers than they are about, you know, science superheroes debunking these pop culture urban myths.
No, I disagree. I think that doesn't tell us anything about the people. It tells you something about the executives at the networks who make these decisions. After all, Adam Savage and Jamie Hyneman had more than a decade on the air with Mythbusters, and it still is one of the most popular TV shows in Discovery's history.
Yeah, but count how many Mythbusters shows there are compared to how many ghost hunting shows there are.
Oh, I know.
It's the market is driven by what people are tuning into.
Yeah.
And, even Mythbusters, though, they had to focus more on explosions than on science.
Yeah, and after a while, they were showing us how an effect was done in a movie instead of actually... But you know what? By then, they had already gone through hundreds of paranormal things or conspiracy theories, the moon landing, all that sort of stuff. So at least they were able to accomplish getting some skepticism into the eyes and ears of Americans.
They did. They were probably one of the better examples we've ever had.
Yeah.
Adam Ruins Everything is the closest thing that we've got on TV right now to a show that directly tackles the myths that people believe.
Absolutely. I've had Adam Kahn over on the show several times, and my wife and I are huge fans of that on True TV every week. And it's a good guy and a great show. Today, I read a story about how the U.S. government is going to release the rest of the files about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas in November 1963. This is because in 1992, Congress passed a law that says, okay, 25 years from now, all the remaining papers can be released. And this Thursday is the end of that 25-year period. And President Trump has said he's not going to put a stop to it. Are you worried that that is going to cause the conspiracy theorists to come out of the woodwork or maybe even grow in number?
Well, it already has just since this announcement was made over the past couple of days. Just last night, I was looking through some internet forums filled with conspiracy theorists talking about this, and they were largely of the belief, you know, finally now the truth is going to come out that, you know, the CIA was behind this or whatever their particular pet belief was. But, you know, I did an episode of the Skeptoid podcast on the JFK assassination, and I've resisted doing it for years and years. And the reason was there are just so many conspiracy theories that it was kind of impossible to tackle that subject in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
In Vince Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, I think it's called, 1,600 pages long, hundreds of conspiracy theories and thousands of trigger men being implicated. It's just an immense, immense subject. The only thing that all these JFK conspiracy theories agree upon is that whatever the government said is wrong. The government's lying. That's it. That's all we know. That's what's important. Anything else is valid. Whether the Cubans did it, or the Mafia did it, or Lyndon B. Johnson did it, that's all fine. Whatever happened, as long as the government was lying, we're happy.
Yep.
And that's basically the conspiracy theory mindset.
Because we can't believe that the government would do anything and tell the truth about it, and yet we believe that the government is so good at what they do that they would have been able to have thousands of people keep this secret for all these years.
Yeah, there was a piece of research that was published a couple of years ago that came up with a formula for determining the likelihood that any given conspiracy theory is true. You take the number of years, the number of people that would have had to be silenced or threatened or killed or whatever it is, and you come up with some probability number.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant formula because it bears out true every time you test it.
There's a new survey just out from Nate Silver's 538. They did it this weekend and found only one in three Americans believe that one man, Lee Harvey Oswald, was responsible for assassinating JFK. Two out of three people think that there was a conspiracy.
It is clearly the leading conspiracy theory in terms of how many people believe it. Even more so than the moon landings or 9/11, which also have really terrifyingly large percentages of support.
Yeah, but
what's going to happen though is just like remember a few years ago, we finally got the lunar surveyor satellite took the pictures of the Apollo moon landing sites. It didn't change anyone's minds.
Right,
people who still believe we never went to the moon. Still believe we never went to the moon.
Well, that's why I kind of that's why I smirked when you said that maybe the conspiracy theorists, after all this comes out, they're all saying, okay, now we're finally going to find out. Well, when this stuff comes out and there is nothing in there that is evidence of their conspiracy, they're going to say, well, the government obviously is still holding something back.
Yeah, they lied. Whatever these papers are, they released, they're false.
Yeah.
It's not going to change any minds. It's fairly true. I've been doing this long enough. I know exactly what's going to happen, and that's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to give you a plug for what you're doing for somehow helping teaching critical thinking in schools. What are you doing?
So my nonprofit, Skeptoid Media, that produces the podcast, we just produced a 40-minute documentary film called Principles of Curiosity, and it's freely available to all in the general public. It's mostly being released to teachers. It has accompanying lesson materials. It teaches anyone how to take something that you hear and how to filter it, how to process it, to learn whether it's true or not, whether it's real or not. So exactly the question you were asking at the beginning of the show here. Here, you watch Principles of Curiosity. We're going to teach you how to follow a simple process to determine whether something is true. It's available for free at principlesofcuriosity.com. It's on YouTube. Go see it.
You can also get the terrific podcast that Brian does every week. It's called Skeptoid by going to the website, skeptoid.com. That's SKEPTOID.com. And you'll hear some of the stories that he tells. He just did one. This wasn't really so much about skepticism, but he just did one about scientists who willingly put themselves in harm's way to try to prove that their inventions worked or that the medicines that they were developing or the systems that they were developing to help people get better worked, and they made themselves guinea pigs. Fascinating stuff, Brian.
Yeah, there are some amazing and harrowing tales of heroism in that episode.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Dunning from Skeptoid. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.